Hello listeners, welcome to another episode of Surviving Society. My name is Dr. Chantelle Jessica Lewis and I'm the executive producer. We've got some really great scholars on the show this week, Kate Haddo and Amy Van Zyl, who are talking about the work primarily of an organisation called Reform. Reform focus on telling the stories of women who have experienced child removal and exploring what can be done to make things fairer. There's some really important myth busting and knowledge sharing in this episode, primarily around the care system. It's a very, very moving episode. It's very challenging to listen to at times, but these are two brilliant women that are passionate, knowledgeable, and really trying to make things happen, and making things happen by sharing knowledge, by supporting people, supporting women, and trying to make some of these stories more accessible to wider audiences. And it's a privilege for us at Surviving Society to give platform to these kind of conversations and organisations. I hope you enjoy the episode and we'll see you again next week. Welcome to Surviving Society,
a political podcast
exploring the local and global politics of race and class
from a sociological perspective.
In conversation with
academics and activists,
researchers and artists,
we platform discussions between knowledge sharers,
creatives and intellectuals,
and change makers.
Our mission is clear:
political education for the masses,
grounded in history,
theory and practice.
Enjoy the episode
and please do share with your networks.
This is a trigger warning. This episode, at times, contains conversations and sensitive material that people may find difficult to listen to.
Welcome to Surviving Society Spotlight Season. My name is Kate Haddo and I'm the guest host of this episode. And I'm joined by the lovely Amy Van Zyl. Amy, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hello, Amy Van Zyl. I'm the chief exec of Reform. Reform's an organisation who focuses on the issue of child removal. So we'll have three pillars that we work within. One is direct work with women who have or are at risk of experiencing child removal. We'll research the topic and engage in systems change to improve things.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for joining us today, Amy. Obviously, we are going to talk about the issue of child removal and a piece of research that we sort of did in collaboration as well with a lovely woman called Bev Hunter McEwen. It's important to mention Bev. So Amy, when we talk about child removal, can you explain to me exactly what we're talking about when we talk about child removal? Because I think it's such a broad topic. Would you mind just sort of telling us what you mean by child removal?
When we talk about child removal, we specifically talk about children who are removed from families, usually mothers, by state intervention. So that would be through social services via the Children's Act.
And Amy, you approached me, God knows how long ago it was now, to do a piece of work on child removal. I was really nervous about doing this work on child removal because it can be such a controversial topic, can't it? So Amy, would you mind just basically telling us what's the crack with child removal sort of in the UK? I mean, we can sort of talk about it mainly from the perspective of the North East, and we know that the North East have got some of the highest rates of child removal in the UK. But can you just give us an overview of, you know, what's going on with child removal? Why is it an issue?
Yeah, definitely. It's so interesting to hear that you are nervous about doing it, because I didn't know that at the time. I'm trying to scan my memory banks to say, can I remember Kate saying she's nervous?
Well, you know, I've worked with people who are on the very edges, if you like, of society. I've worked with people who are, you know, in the middle of addiction and things like that. And I remember talking to my partner about it. And I remember saying, I'm really scared because my sort of views on child removal were basically influenced by the media. I was basically thinking around, you know, all of the headline news that you see. And I was just like, oh my God, Amy's asking me to work with people who, you know, have done X, Y, or Z to their children. And it wasn't until I actually started working with you and obviously working with these amazing women, I was like, oh my God, I got this so wrong. And I can't believe how wrong I got it. Because I would like to think, you know, I'm relatively educated and really...
You are very educated and very liberal, very liberal. So that is... And I totally second everything you said, you know, before this became a topic of my work. And like, it absolutely dominates everything that I do now. But before that, I would have absolutely sat in judgment of somebody who lost the children, because I would have had that inbuilt faith in the system, though God knows why, I don't know. But I would have had an inbuilt faith in justice, and that if children are removed, it's because they're in danger. And actually, there are topics I can't go anywhere near. And it's where children are harmed. So I absolutely appreciate you know, feeling of, I'm not sure that I can do work, you know, with people who are harming children. And I don't think I could either. What's really interesting is the longer that I've studied this and worked alongside women, and I'm doing a master's at the moment in social work to understand it from a social worker's perspective now. Yeah. And the longer I go into it, I can see that there's two tracks. My assumption prior to investigation was that children were removed because they were being harmed by parents. Mm. That does happen. So that still happens. That's why we still require laws to be able to do that. It's right that we do that, you know. And
oh, absolutely. But child removal will probably always be needed, you know what I mean?
Yes.
In those extreme cases. Yeah.
And I think we do say that in the beginning of the Still a Mom report. It's a feature of society that will probably always be required in some form. And just like we'll always have murderers in society, mm-hmm. we'll probably always have people who will harm children. However, that's not what the mass landscape of child removal in the UK is. Actually, what we're seeing is children are removed because they're with parents. They're suffering the consequences of parents who have multiple and unmet needs. So you've got people who we would characterise as unwell, and that would be, you know, socially, physically, mentally, but they're unwell, require support, and will have a bleak view at the moment and landscape for people where there is no support. And so failure to support the parents means that we can't offer support, but we can offer removal, and that's what we're going for. So just to kind of zoom out and give you some statistics on it, I think we have more than 100,000 children in care at the moment. It's expected to rise past, I think, 120,000 was the last review, is the expectation in the coming years. We have seen in the Northeast, which is where we're based and where we did our research, we've seen a 77% increase in the number of children going into care since austerity. And so the link between poverty, austerity, and defunding so many of public services that people rely on has meant that we've ended up where we are removing children in extreme numbers. So out of the 20 worst performing local authorities in the country, the Northeast has 12.
Wow, I actually didn't know that. Wow, that's bad.
It is harrowing. It's absolutely harrowing. And there's loads of things that feed into it. The most common reasons that children are taken into care is substance misuse within the parents, domestic abuse, homelessness, and mental health issues. And I know that we know, because we are from a background, of multiple and complex needs, that, you know, these things are absolutely poverty driven, that these things are class driven. Yeah. And we know that this is a sociological podcast, so everyone, I'm presuming, is going to be familiar with Michael Marmot. Michael Marmot showed that there is a postcode to health. Depending on what postcode you live in, that will indicate how long you will live and how well you will live because of the environment, the education, you know, what you're exposed to, so many factors, the wider determinants of health. We know that that gradient, we know that all of those things impact whether or not you're going to be able to keep your children. But I was in a session with Newcastle Council where they talked about the difference between Gosforth and Jesmond numbers of child removal. And I'm pretty sure the ratio was something like 1 to 12,000. And then the ratio in the poorest areas of the city, and it was in double figures. So it went from thousands to doubles. Yeah. I mean, it was terrifying. So, yes, this is absolutely driven by inequalities in society.
I know this is something that always upset me, but what is as well is the impact of child removal on like the mother, and I know this is something that absolutely like left me in tears.
It's devastating. It's absolutely devastating. Yeah. So the women that we worked with and the women that we work with at Reform, you know, who weren't involved in this but have contributed to the stuff that we do, and the work of Karen Broadhurst, you know, she's been studying this since 2014, her amazing paper on collateral consequences, is women who experience child removal, they report it as the worst thing they've ever experienced. And these were tough women, that the toughest women I've ever met. So they would sit in front of us and they would talk about being sexually exploited, they would talk about domestic abuse, they would talk about torture. Some of them were tortured. One girl was trafficked when she was a teenager across county lines. She was sold into a sex ring. Nothing came close for any of them to when their child was removed from them
by social services. And that was the point of a real dip for all of them. So where life had been pretty bad before that, it was terrible after. And we know that statistically, women who do have the children removed, they're more likely to go back to perpetrators of domestic abuse. And this has a lot to do with the shame and stigma that surrounds these women. You know, they can't talk about it, but these perpetrators give them a safe place. Like, it wasn't your fault. You know, they're out to get you. I'm on your side. They give them somewhere to go. And so they're in increased danger of harm from perpetrators. These women are at much greater risk of suicide and accidental overdose. Glasgow University did a study a little while ago. They're the drug death capital of Europe. And they did a study into, you know, what are the factors that go into it? And child removal was one of the factors. I mean, Embrace brought data out last year, which showed that all 10 teenage mothers who'd committed suicide in the first 12 months of giving birth, they'd all experienced child removal. Like, it... child removal is an indicator of premature death in women.
Yeah, it's actually killing women.
It's actually killing women. Yeah, it's killing women. I mean, and it's so strange because we are outliers in Europe. Like, we are, it's a really unusual practice. And I've started to speak to midwives, and actually there was a really interesting midwife I spoke to not long ago who was retraining to do a PhD looking at this. So she was doing, I think it was substances and maternal experiences of women, but child removal was coming into it more and more. And basically she'd swapped from doing what she was doing to this PhD because she witnessed a woman lose her children at birth, and it was such a harrowing experience for her. She couldn't go back to it, and that is the experience. So one of the papers that I want to do, one of the studies I want to do next, is I want to work with staff who are working in those environments and witnessing this happening alongside women who've experienced it, and do a cross comparison of it, because actually it's not just the women who are experiencing this. That individual midwife, she said that if she closes her eyes, and this was some years ago now, she closed her eyes, she can still hear that woman scream. She said it was so primal, more likely to be homeless, more likely to suffer mental health issues, more likely to use substances. So just all the terrible outcomes, more likely to have. But children don't get out of this scot-free either.
Yeah, what is the outcome for these children? I mean, I suppose most of us would think, right, these children have been removed, they're going to go into like a better home, the outcomes are then going to be absolutely amazing, but actually it isn't. And I was really shocked at that. What are the outcomes for these kids?
I mean, some children do have a great time of it. I've got a friend who is a foster carer, and honestly, I was thinking the other day about it, and I was thinking, if I was to get hit by the number 7 bus tomorrow, I would love my two children to go with her. You know, she is absolutely wonderful. She has two children in a long-term placement, and she has given them a life beyond their wildest dreams. You know, she's radically in all of the fairy tale ways that we want to wish these children off in the sunset. She provides that. So that does exist. It is possible. But statistically, it's not the majority of cases. So children who go into care, more likely to be excluded from school, either temporarily or permanently, less likely to achieve or attain GCSEs, more likely to be NEETs, not in education or training. We know that these all then filter into your life outcomes. So you, harrowingly, more likely to have a child who's then taken into care. So if you are a child who's raised in care, you're more likely to use substances, you're more likely to get into abusive relationships. Lots of factors that go into that. So there is, I believe, the thing that is absolutely unaddressed in all of this. So you read a lot of studies that talk about the damage to children in that home environment. Yeah. They move into a care system that nurtures them but can never make up for the damage that was done in the original home. I think that completely negates the trauma that they've experienced in the actual removal, in being taken away and then existing without that parent. And there's some really odd practices that go on, such as reducing children's contact with birth parents ahead of them being settled into a new home, and the belief that if they see much less of the parent, they'll settle into the new home. easier. Mm-hmm. But certainly, anecdotally and first-hand experience of this, I have not witnessed that that be true at all. And it actually, the child doesn't want it, the birth mother doesn't want it, yeah. It doesn't provide great outcomes for the foster carers either, because they've got a child who is traumatised and going through a traumatised experience. So just, just really lots and lots of complicated factors that go into it. But anyway, these children who are more likely to suffer from all of these things, it then puts them in that category as teenage parents or young parents of mm-hmm. you have all these additional needs, there is nothing there to support you, but we can remove your child. And throughout the ages, you know, if you look at the life course of a person, it's absolutely this is financially driven, because you can really easily find, even in the hardest of boroughs, and I've witnessed this firsthand in a social services setting, so I've been in, I've watched it, babies who come in, so pre-birth and just born and under two, they're really, really quick to remove, they're really punitive, it's really fast action, because it's really, one of the reasons is it's really easy to find a home for that baby. But as that child ages up, there's less and less chance of the child being removed. And sometimes I've witnessed children being left in really unsafe conditions, and people shrugging and deciding at that point, well, it's we don't get to tell people how to live. It's life choices. And yet map exactly the same very young children and babies. Oh. And it's, you know, this parent's a disgrace and putting this child at risk. We need to remove this child straight away. And I don't think that is not a conscious shift that is happening within that team, you know, but it is absolutely happening. And I've witnessed it firsthand. So, and that is driven by economic resource. But we now have teams set up. There's one team I worked with recently called an Educare team. And this is a team set up to stop children who are on the edge of going into care. So right, my cup of tea. Let's
prevent it. Yeah.
Yes, this is amazing. So I'm really into it. Now, it's been developed. The method that they use has been developed by Colleen Furman, who I'm a huge fan of, absolutely massive fan of. She developed contextual safeguarding, which was looking at how do we perceive the harms to these children from outside of the home. So it was no longer looking at the interfamilial harm, it was extra familial harm. And so I went to this team and I said, okay, so who are we dealing with in this team? And they said, okay, so we're dealing with children where the relationship's breaking down, and as a result there's a chance that we might have to place them in care. These are children who are 11 and older. And I said, so what's the background of these children? And she said, it was the manager of the team that I was with, and she said, well, we've got children who are in kinship carers, with kinship carers, so they've been removed from the parents and they've been placed with family members, and then they've hit the teenage years and it's breaking down. Or we've got children who are we've got adoptions that are breaking down, children that have been removed from parents and then adopted in the early years, and then come in the teenage years it's breaking down. I was like, right. Or we've got long-term foster placements where they've been removed. So the first three categories of children that we're dealing with are children that have been removed from parents and the placement's breaking down. And we now have an entire department. Or they can be exploited from outside the home. So stuff that's going on as well as those things.
Yeah.
The children will be exploited from outside the home, and they may or may not be, you know, have been removed. Or there's substance misuse, but that's a sign of other things. I said,
yeah,
I agree. Yes, I agree. And she went on to say, you know, if they're using substances, it's usually an indicator of trauma. I'm nodding vigorously, because every woman I've ever worked with who has any issues of addiction has suffered trauma, and it is a trauma response. Anyway, I said, okay, well, what if the parent was presenting with those same behaviours? Bear in mind, a lot of these parents they have been in care. Yeah. They will have experienced these traumas. Yeah. So I said, so what if it's the parent who's that lifestyle choices? No, that's a safeguarding concern. That's with the family's team. Now, for me, in my naivety,
I cannot see the difference between a child who's traumatized and acting out and an adult child who's traumatized and acting out. Yeah. I have the same level of compassion for both, but it's clear one provides an opportunity for intensive support and the other one gets put into a punitive process of assessment. This team, what they offer is 6 months, up to 6 months intensive work with family workers, not with social workers, where they really work on whatever the core issues are in communication with the families, in making them safe and looking at what's going on around them to reduce the risks from outside of the home. And they're going to be doing things with the larger communities. So they're going to be doing things with the police, with the local authority, parks and spaces and things like really good, amazing social work. Yeah, absolutely fabulous. Anyway, their success rate of keeping families together is 91%. I could have weeped. I mean, it's everything that I would want for our families. Map that onto the families that are being dealt with in the families team by social workers. And what was happening there was families come in. It's usually a presenting issue, a safeguard and concern from the parents. I would say every single case I've ever witnessed was, but I haven't witnessed a huge amount. So, I mean, gosh, I don't know what the statistics would be, but they've got to be 90 and over. So the presenting issue is parent has mental health issues. This provides a safeguard and concern. So what happens, I can give you a really good example. So I thought the system was people, families, children need help, social services provide help, and safeguarding where needed, right? So that's my layman's understanding of it. So just to give you an example of how untrue that is, I sat in a duty team one day and a phone call came in and it was from a nurse who was concerned, 68-year-old dad who, with a 12-year-old son, was here, didn't have any family, had arrived at hospital for surgery. He'd actually arrived 2 days early, bless him. But when he was, so they arranged for him to come back in 2 days, how that was going to look. And they said, who's going to have your son while you're in? And he said, he's just going to look after himself because it was an overnight. But he said, we are hungry. We haven't got any food in the house and we're hungry. So she'd put a call in to the emergency team. It was a Saturday. And the social worker who took the call, who was a manager, was really annoyed and said, why are they ringing us with that? I couldn't understand why they wouldn't. I said, is it all right for the 12-year-old to be at home alone? And she went, oh yeah, it's not legal. That's his choice. If he thinks he's old enough, he can make that decision. I said, okay. And she said, anyway, I've passed it on to the police that can do a welfare check. So I was horrified and I said, why the police? And she says, well, we haven't got the threshold to do anything with this. And I said, but he said he's hungry. So could we not just take a food parcel? There's food parcels in the building. There was loads of them. I said, and they're for anybody who needs them. I said, could we not just drop a food parcel off? He said he's hungry. We could knock on the door, say, here's the food parcel. We heard you're hungry. They sent a call in. Is there anything else we can do to help? And she said, no, we haven't got the threshold for that. And I could not understand what she was saying to us. And then I said, so how do the police have the threshold? I could not understand this, what this threshold word meant. And she said, they can gain entry into the home. At this stage, we can't. And so the view that she had on this case was exclusively from a perspective of powers. So what powers have I got in this situation to execute? And thresholds get you into those powers. The view that she wasn't looking through was, these people need help. How do we best help them? So that poor man was going to have the police knock on the door and the police check if he's got food in his cupboard. So instead of, and he did the right thing. Like, he was in a hospital. He was speaking to a nurse. He said, we're hungry. I mean, we know the cost of living crisis at the moment. He's 68. So presumably a pensioner, single parent with a son alone on his own in the UK. And that's how it was dealt with. So
immediately just jump straight to the police rather than any form of social support.
There is no social support.
I remember you telling me about how this sort of middle class woman had dropped her children off at nursery and there were, let's just say, a little bit sort of, you know, scruffy in their appearance. I think their, you know, their fingernails are really dirty. And I think we definitely do associate child removal with, if you like, poorer women when we know that this is a class issue. Would you agree with that? Is that something you 100% think that this is around social class?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt, it's social class. It's absolutely driven by social class. And I feel like I could do an entire podcast on the shift in class, the shift in class nature of social workers as well. So okay. I think historically, social workers have absolutely been jolly hooky sticks, lefty goodies, right? So like that was the stereotype of who a social worker was. My experience of social workers today is they are mostly from working class backgrounds. So most of the social workers I've come into contact with in the Northeast are from working class or lower working class backgrounds. So they've done incredibly well. They've got through university. God bless the tyranny of the meritocracy. So we've got a completely different landscape of who's doing this. But what I've witnessed is that it is those working class social workers. It is not the middle class social workers, but it's the working class social workers who are painfully judgmental of working class, lower working class service users. So we've got, so there's one woman, this isn't about the interaction between social care. So she was middle class, or certainly had all of the trappings of a middle class lifestyle anyway, including being able to assert herself, advocate for herself, had an education. Whoa. And it's those qualities that really make the difference. Like when you boil it down, it's that level of, I don't want to say entitlement, but absolute Karenism, right? Yeah. That does get you. I'm like a massive advocate of being a bit of a Karen. So so anyway, this woman was an alcoholic and fighting for her children back. And bless her, she didn't know she was an alcoholic. She just hadn't had that moment of awakening. So she was going through the process and desperately wanted to have a blood test, or a hair strand test, sorry, to prove that she wasn't an alcoholic. And she really believed this would prove she was an alcoholic. And then at the last moment, they were in court and they agreed to do the hair strand test. And had they done it when they originally removed her children, she would have never had her children back, because she was so tanked up most of her life. She would have tested positive. But come doing the test, and it was before the judge, she turned around to our barrister and said, "Sorry, can I just ask, I can still drink wine with dinner." And our barrister was like, you know, a bit embarrassed. I said, like, what level are they looking for here? And are they looking for abstinence? And he said, oh, and then said to the judge, oh, mum can still drink wine with dinner, can't she? And the judge said, oh, yes, yes. And looked at the social workers, and the social workers all nodded their heads. And so she didn't have to have absolute abstinence.
Oh, wow.
So she could have some alcohol. Now, what that translated to in real terms was she had about, I don't know, 8 benders, where it, over the course of the hair strand test, it had evened out and it showed that she was just moderate levels of alcohol. And that said so much about the social workers didn't understand that she was an alcoholic, didn't understand what alcoholism was. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely a class that made her say, oh, hang on a minute, even though I'm going through this really punitive process and, you know, I should be groveling at everybody's feet, she still had it about her to say, oh, wait, we don't have to lose, I don't have to have this infringement on my human rights. That is not something that happens with women from lower class backgrounds.
Absolutely not.
The women from lower class backgrounds have heard the most gratuitous language about them. So they don't have any of those skills to advocate for themselves. And then the language that's used around them is, she's lazy.
I think as well, like a lot of them don't feel that they have the right to kind of question things like that, do they? I think that they view themselves as
less than.
Yeah. Because this is who I am and kind of this is what I deserve almost. That's the kind of impression that I got when we were doing the research.
Yes, definitely. I mean, shame and stigma and how it manifests in this is, you know, they don't talk about it. So they're in their own ego chamber of self-hate, and the stories that they tell themselves, you know, they walk into it in the same way that we walk into it. You know, we walked into it thinking children who are removed from mothers, you know, these mothers must be really bad. And so when it happens to them, they've become this like subhuman group.
And there is a lot of dehumanization that goes on in this, but they've become this subhuman group. I mean, how do you claw yourself out of that when you don't have anybody to talk to and you don't want to fight against it, and your whole world's turned upside down? You know, you believe you love your child, you believe you do the best for your child, and yet somebody else is standing over you telling you that is not the case. Mm. And so it just creates this, they don't advocate for themselves. I did see a woman advocate for herself a few weeks ago, and it was so sad for different reasons. But, you know, she was in a meeting advocating for herself really well. I was so impressed with her, and she was young. This was her first child. What she didn't know, but all of the professionals in the room knew, was that they were going to place the child permanently out of her care with maternal grant. And she didn't know that. So she was still advocating for her right to, you know, because she still had PR. So she was advocating for her right to pick the child's school and to get more time with the child. And they didn't say no to her because she didn't know that she was, and they didn't want to tell her yet that they'd already decided she wasn't getting a child. So they were playing a game of, well, we'll just appease her and not speak to our points because we know we need to reduce the contact down for this child because it's going to be permanently placed with Gran. And so she was just getting stonewalled throughout the meeting, and, you know, our anxiety was just increasing and increasing. And I thought, they're not even playing the same game. They're not playing the same game. This is so awful. So it doesn't matter how well she plays it. She's playing the wrong game. She can't win. There's a woman managing a service where she's coming across a lot of these women, and we had like a bit of a supervision session with each other, because we'd both been dealing with some really stressful cases. And she went, the next piece of research you do, Amy, it needs to be the can it win. They haven't got a chance. Yeah. That's the title. They haven't got a chance because they haven't got a chance. I feel so bad being so strident about this, but honestly, at the moment, the way things are set up, they haven't got a chance.
Do you want to walk us through the key findings? So what we did was, is we did some interviews with women who'd experienced child grooming. I think we interviewed about 10 women. And do you want to walk us, if you like, what did we find from our research? Like, you know, what were the issues that were coming up in these interviews?
Well, the issues that were focused on in this paper was, we talked about relationships matter.
Yeah.
And it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. So relationships matter hits in a few areas. So we've already kind of talked about it a little bit about, you know, the powers of being able to advocate for yourself. But one of the things that was so devastating was these women were stepping into a professional environment. Everybody in that room was, well, they were usually degree educated, if not, they were, you know, higher educated. They were employed, they had competencies to work to, they had training, they had managers and supervision. You know, there's a lot of stuff around these people to be able to do their job and do their job well. And these women were kind of dropped into it without any of that, but failure to perform resulted in losing their children. One of the things that would combat that is building effective relationships. And actually, these women, certainly the ones that we interviewed, you know, they were the least likely to be able to do that. These are women who had suffered a domestic abuse relationship. I mean, most women involved had relationships where they were abusive.
I couldn't believe how much these women were punished for the actions of men.
You, I remember when we did it, and there was one woman in particular, and she went to the toilet, and we were like, on the break, you were like, misogyny, Amy, surely misogyny is what we're going to talk about. It was just terrible. So that came in, it's not your fault, but it's your responsibility. So children are frequently removed from mothers because, quote unquote, they fail to protect the children. Okay, so the one story that I always quote was that woman. She had a history of, you know, bad relationship after bad relationship, but she'd broken up the relationship. She had three children, I think, two at home. Ex had come and put her windows out, so she phoned the police, and they came and they brought the windows up, and he wasn't arrested, there was no evidence. Then he came back a week or two later, and he set fire to her car outside of her house. So she, you know, she wrapped her kids up, got them in the back garden, phoned the police again, and the fire brigade, and they came, they put the fire out, and then social services came and removed our children and said, you know, you can't keep them safe here. If you, never mind her, like, does she not have a right to stay safe? And there was a perpetrator of this crime. You know, those three people could have continued to live in that house had this man been arrested. The short end to this story is he was never arrested and he was never prosecuted because there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute. So in criminal law, you need evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to convict. Mm. In the Children's Act, which is what governs child removal, you need suspicion of risk of harm. So in that case, there was enough suspicion of risk of harm to the children to remove them, but there wasn't enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, even though we all have enough suspicion of risk of harm to say that this man is absolutely a risk to these children and this woman. But anyway, yeah. And then, like, my argument here is the police failed to protect those children from harm. The social worker failed to protect those children from harm. The community failed to protect those children from harm. So many people didn't protect those children from that man. That man created all of the harm in that situation. But nothing ever happened to him. She removed her children and she did move house. So she had to give up her home. She moved into a home that didn't have carpets or curtains.
Yeah.
She was assured by social services and by the local authority she would get carpets and curtains. By the time we spoke to her, it was September. She'd been in her home for, I think, I want to say 5 months by the time we were speaking to her, and she still didn't have carpets and curtains. When we said to her at the end of the interview, is there anything we can do? Like, what can we do? She said, can you just get us that sorted? And I made a phone call and I spoke to somebody. She had stuff within a few days. And that wasn't because I did anything special. I did nothing special, but I certainly had what she didn't have. I had professional credibility. I knew how to ask for things. I knew where to go for advice and guidance because I'm trained to. And, you know, we did the Still a Mom event and I said to every practitioner in that room, every single one of you could have done this for this woman. And she didn't necessarily have the skills for herself. There was loads of other in it. So she moved into this house. She still didn't have her children back. She didn't have her children back because they said, well, it's not habitable. You know, you don't have carpets, you don't have curtains. It's not the right environment for the children, so you can't have them back. So she was still going through that process. A car, she'd lost her car. The insurance payout wasn't enough to buy a new car. And our insurance premiums were then five times what they were originally. So she couldn't afford to drive. None of that was her fault, but it was entirely her responsibility to fix it if she wanted to get her children back. And we're talking about someone who's in a really weakened state. I often talk about, so I have a public health background, and I often talk about, and you know, the World Health Organization says that health includes social well-being. So I view social work as a health profession. It is absolutely about health. And so I often use health analogies when I talk about this. And I say, you know, families are coming into social services, like they come into A&E with a broken leg. And we're saying to them, we're going to amputate. And you're like, whoa, it's broken. It's fixable. Well, not here. We haven't got the resource for it. We're just doing amputations. And then we're sending people on their way. And we're expecting that to be fine. And that's how reductive social work is becoming. Certainly with her, like, this was entirely preventable. Absolutely, entirely preventable.
And it always amazes me, like, the dad never gets spoken about. And I laugh because we always say, oh, what about the man? And like, yeah, what about the man? What punishment is that man facing? And, you know, why does nobody talk about the dad? It's always the mom.
I had a friend who did a piece of work, because what we haven't talked about is the cost to society. Actually, running services like this is insanely expensive. This is draining. I mean, I think every single local authority, the largest budget holder is social services, and it's dire. And if you think about, you've got a food box upstairs, which maybe costs £6, and you can send that out to that family that we mentioned before. You can send out a £6 food box and spend £12 of a family worker's time delivering it versus two police officers, one call handler, two police officers going out, them going back to the office and making a report, then making a referral to social services. Social services are going to read that, review it, update their records, may or may not trigger a 45-day investigation at the lowest level. It's a 45-day, and that's involvement with the social worker for 45 days. Like, this is insanely expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Amy, what should change about child removal if we had Rishi Sunak? And yes, I did say that right, Rishi Sunak. What would you change around child removal if we had him in the room? And I mean, me and you be both screaming at him. What would you say needs to change? And I
do you know what it is? It mostly isn't the law. So a lot of this stuff that we get involved in, people say, you know, which laws need to change to do this? We have loads of laws that adequately protect families. This mm-hmm. is stuff that we could change on Monday. This is stuff that if we wanted to, we could make huge and meaningful change in people's lives on Monday. And I would say there needs to be a shift in perspective, and there needs to be a shift towards how do we help? What yeah. help do people need? And recognizing that. And the thing that we haven't talked nearly enough about is misogyny and how ingrained that is in it. Misogyny and classism were the two things that I've witnessed in practice that are most harrowing. These women are being judged and held accountable for things that are absolutely not their fault and shouldn't be their responsibility to fix. It absolutely should not be their responsibility to fix the things that are going on. Mm-hmm. Failures in society should not just be dropped at the hands at the feet of women and blame placed on them. A lot of this is about blame.
It's funny because one thing I've been meant to tell you about, I took my mum to see lasagna. You know,
oh, lovely. Yes.
I totally forgot to tell you. And I laughed because my mum, I think, I was a bit nervous about taking my mum because, again, around that whole sort of stigma around child removal. And Amy, if you were to have my mum, and my mum loved it, by the way, absolutely loved it. She thought it was brilliant, completely changed her view. I was like, oh my God, it must have been powerful. I want you to basically say to my mum, why should my mum care about child removal? Why should Jim off the street care about child removal?
Because it could happen to you, because it could be her grandchild. I think the thing that keeps people from compassion within this subject is the othering that we do to this group in society. We believe that it happens to other people, the bad guys, not good people. And actually it isn't. It would be me and it would be you if we had hard circumstances. So a lot of this is mental health issues. If you've got mental health, so one woman who has just lost a child recently, she was raised in care. She's got related trauma to that, and they've decided because that trauma is untreated and it's going to take 18 months to get her on the waiting list or to get her through the waiting list to speak to a psychologist or psychiatrist to start the work of processing her childhood, they've removed her child because they think it's unreasonable to let that child wait for her to work through these things. There are no other issues going on in that woman's life other than that. And that is something that could happen to me or to you. You know, you need to be the victim of a crime or a bereavement was something that came up in these stories a lot. You know, Bev was really good at pointing that out, is a lot of these people had mental health issues due to a bereavement. And it was, you know, it was the lack of compassion around that bereavement and any resource available that meant the dip to such a degree. And remember, you've got mental health issues, it dips to such a degree, there is zero support, so what do you do?
And
that's basically it. And then of course it's domestic abuse, and you are not responsible for what somebody else does. How do you reach out and ask for help? So a lot of the cases, so a huge theme that goes across all of these stories is women do not reach out for help. Because if you reach out for help, it brings you to the attention of services, starts the assessment process, and you're going to be assessed at your weakest period of your life.
I was really shocked at that. There was no support, was there? It was just immediately, let's start punishing you. No sort of like, I tell you what, let's try A, let's try B, let's try C. It was just immediately like, as you say, it kickstarted this process of punishment and actually, we're going to remove your children.
And the flip side of that, so the argument would be, well, we do try this and we do try that. And if we didn't, then the judge would never pass it. But I've actually seen what that looks like close up. And what it looks like is, well, we asked mum to make a referral to Humankind. That's our drug service locally. Mm-hmm. And she didn't. She failed to engage. That's not good enough. That is not good enough. That is not trying, and it's not her responsibility. Like, you've got women who are terrified if they go to the drug service and they talk about what's happening, they talk about relapsing, that then goes back to social services. Social services now know how many times she's relapsed, build a case for why she's incapable to have a child. So she's not going to engage with that service. Like, why would she engage with that service? She'd have to be mental to engage with that service.
What needs to change, Amy?
Perspectives needs to change. So what social workers are there to do needs to change. I think there does need to be a radical shift. So we know that the needle exchange that we do, it promotes people being able to come in and get clean needles. It promotes better health. You know, it stops the spread of HIV and the likes. That is better for society. We need to have a similar thing for women accessing support. Women can't access support because there's a threat that if they access support, they get reported to social services as a safeguarding risk to their children. This then stops women accessing support, means that they go downhill really fast, and means that they're more likely to have their children removed as a result, or worse still, for those older children, for children to be left in really painful circumstances with parents who are not coping.
Yeah. Oh, Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Surviving Society.
To support our work, you can rate,
review and subscribe. To host or produce a series of Surviving Society,
get in touch with us via Twitter or Instagram.